I worked in Claire's Accessories, which is a purveyor of jewellery and useless stuff, basically, for small children. And I also pierced small children generally while they were screaming, but hopefully retrieved after I'd done it. So after those 2 years, I applied for a job in Holland and Barrett. And I remember in Belfast when I named the store that I worked for, I became, is that, you know, because it had all been kind of nobody had put it forward that I was naming the store or anything like that. But I'm actually not going to say anything particularly bad about or false about Holland and Barrett. They were definitely, out of the three employers that I had in the retail sector, they were the better employers. I was very well paid. The conditions of work were very, very good. And when I was there, I really did genuinely think that I was learning an awful lot of very useful information. So that was the reason that I was in the shop. So I wasn't there as kind of a career move or anything like that. I was really just to get money for art supplies, usually, and for rent. Holland and Barrett are kind of an interesting... doesn't want to talk to me. There, so that's my store, that's where I worked in Grafton Street, which was, when it opened in 2008, I started working there in 2008, so it was an absolutely brand new store. It's just across from BT2's on Grafton Street, and it was the flagship store of Dublin. It was going to be the very largest one that we had, and it was before that, some of you might remember the chain store that was in Ireland called Nature's Way. And Nature's Way were bought out by Holland and Barrett. So you can see under it says partners with Nature's Way, but pretty much any semblance of Nature's Way is pretty much gone at this point. There's a few staff left. And Nature's Way, and I know a lot of people kind of very much lamented when that happened, because Nature's Way were an Irish company. They were run by Irish people. And Holland and Barrett, as I will explain, are a very large international company that are owned by what some people would consider to be fairly nefarious people. So when I first did this talk in Belfast, I knew really nothing about who owned Holland and Barrett or anything like that. I knew that they were owned by an American company, and when I started working there, they were. It's an American company called, if you go to the next slide, actually, I was at the acronym wrong, NBTY. This was the shirt that I got to wear. It was a very nice green check shirt, which was then replaced with an even more green shirt, which, for those of us who had red hair who worked in the store, it was a very bad move, colour coordination wise. The girls wore really green, and the guys got to wear bottle green. So there was a few girls who had red hair who wore men's shirts because they refused to clash that badly. But this is the company that they originally... And this company still exists, MBTY. And they... not only do they make all of the supplements that Holland and Barrett sell, you probably all know that they only have their own range, which are under all sorts of like Good and Natural, all those ones. They all look different, but they're all made by Holland and Barrett if you look at the back. And MBTY is a large American company who bought out the Holland and Barrett company in 1997. Before that, Holland and Barrett had been owned by Lloyd's Pharmacy. Holland and Barrett was originally set up in 1870 and was a grocer's and a draper's, and kind of slowly over the years became a purveyor of natural remedies. It was originally set up by two guys, oddly enough, called Holland and Barrett. and some of you may remember the very, very ill-fated, there was an advertising campaign a few years ago where they had two very curmudgeonly men wandering around the shop, one called Mr. Barrett and one called Mr. Holland, and Mr. Holland was wearing clogs. And I thought it was a really dreadful dreadful ad campaign. It didn't last very long. Now they have the really nice-looking kind of gym buff guy who goes in and tells you one thing's going to be a penny. But when I worked there, I think this was a girl from the London store who got to be the face of Holland and Barrett for a while, so she was on all the merchandising on the inside. But MBTY were bought over in 2010 by the Carlyle Group. And some of you may have heard of the Carlyle Group. They're a very large investment group, if you go to them. The Carlyle Group have been written about an awful lot, and have appeared in an awful lot of documentaries, because there's an awful lot of conspiracy theory involved in the Carlyle Group. The Iron Triangle, when I first came across it, I think this is a new cover, so when I first investigated this, there was a wonderful line drawing on the cover that was just two hands doing this, which I thought was fantastic, the Iron Triangle. I thought it was fantastic. Can't find that cover anymore. Basically, the Carlyle Group is the connection that was made between the Bin Ladens and the Bush family. That was the investment group that the two of them were involved in, and that was the link that people made. So they're supposedly involved in all sorts of horrible, high-level machinations in America. And as you may have guessed by the time you did the Illuminati thing here, they're kind of implied in a New World Order as well. But I have to say, when I was working in Holland and Barrett, I didn't realise that I was a minion in the green shirt. I didn't know that was going on. So it was kind of interesting to find out retrospectively. So At the time, NBTY was worth an awful lot of money. Carlyle Group bought them for about $55 a share, which at the time was $3.4 to $3.8 billion. So that's a big chunk of money. So you can imagine that this Holland & Barrett, you know, it does turn over, along with Nature's Bounty and NBTY, and GNC is another one that you might see in the UK. That's the one that's done mostly for sports nutrition. They're all owned by the same large group. When I did the talk up in Belfast, I didn't have slides. So I basically wrote down all the different things that I'd ever taken when I worked in Holland & Barrett. And the one thing that I noticed, all of my life I've suffered from several kind of chronic conditions. I've suffered from eczema, migraine, acne, all kinds of things that doctors generally can't do a huge amount about. They're just things that you have to manage. So over the years, my mum had brought me to several different practitioners. I'd been to healers and alternative clinicians and things like that. So I'd always kind of had a low-level acceptance of alternative therapies in my life. I had no problem with that. My aunt is a reflexologist, that kind of thing. So when I started working in Holland & Barrett, I would have taken a certain amount of supplements. I would have taken multivitamin and maybe even primrose oil for my skin and things like that. But what I noticed when I started working there, when you're surrounded by it, you start to suddenly realise how you need one of every single thing in the shop. And every time there was a news story, or Holland & Barrett had their own magazine called Healthy, which would have regular kind of the latest science shows that bilberry is actually really, really good for your eyesight, and it wasn't blueberry all along, and this kind of thing. So what I noticed was it was very much a snowball effect, and before I knew it, I was taking a lot of supplements in a day. And one that I never questioned, even when I worked in the shop, was the back flare remedies. And Colin has already mentioned homeopathic remedies, and I didn't actually realise that Dr. Bach, the guy who came up with this, was a homeopath, and that back flare remedies are homeopathic preparations. They're homeopathic preparations of flowers, basically. And when he started developing these remedies, he would go around. He basically came up with a system of belief where he said that flowers have psychic energy, a psychic spiritual energy, to do with the properties that they have in life. And that if you were to collect these flowers in the morning, if you were to collect their dew, because the sunlight had passed through the dew and was in contact with the flower, then that water, in the same way as homeopaths believe that that water has memory, he believed that that water had memory, and then that could be made into a preparation to deal with specifically emotional ideas. So each of there's 38 plant and flower remedies that you can get in the back range. It's not just rescue remedy. Rescue remedy is seven particular ones put together. But people believe that each of these correlated with an emotional state. One that I particularly like, that I think I might need myself, is centurion, which is the ability to say no, because I quite like food. I quite like food, and all of that. So it was only developed in the 1930s, and rescue remedy has exploded. You can get rescue remedy in every format that you like. You can get them in little pastilles. You can get them chewing gum now, which I didn't realise, and a cream, which I really can't understand. If you're treating an emotional problem, why applying a cream would help in any way, I don't really know, unless it's a stress-induced skin thing, which as a sufferer of eczema, I can see how you can make that logical leap. But I don't think anybody who really buys back off the shelf in this format, not particularly the constituent ones themselves, like the crab apple and things like that, you get them by themselves. I don't think anybody really realises that it is a homeopathic preparation, because that really is kind of kept quiet in the literature around it. We used to have a little book that you could look up. You could look up your emotional state, and it would tell you the specific combination of the different ones that you should take. And it would say to take them so many times in water, or you could dilute it into 2 litres and drink it throughout the day. So you're taking a dilute substance, and you're diluting it even further into your 2 litres, and that's supposed to help with your... Some of the ones that it prescribes for are quite serious, like the idea of you never do anything good with your life is one of them, or an overwhelming feeling of depression. You're kind of thinking that probably if you're dealing with those kind of emotions, a tiny little tincture of this kind of thing isn't really going to be the answer for it. But again, when we were talking about... We were talking about the placebo effect. In this one it says... this is a little quote from Holland & Barrett at the top of the website where they have all the rescue remedy. We use by all the family, and also it also recommends that you can use it on pets. So if your pet is feeling particularly depressed, you could go for that as well. I'll go for the next one then.
Give it a joy.
This is something that didn't exist when I worked at Holland and Barr. And this is the emotional eating support kit, which I was quite surprised didn't include sensory. So you can see this is again from the Holland and Barr website. So this is the explanation as to why these three are good. So you can see there. So you can help. This kind of cherry plum is for kind of losing control and things like that. Well, I actually didn't mention the seven that are in the backfire remedy. But one of them the backfire remedy is rock rose, impassions, clematis, star, Bethlehem, and cherry plum. And cherry plum, which is also in this one, but if you go to the back centre website, and there is a register of back practitioners, which I also don't know, cherry plum is described on their website as fear of mind giving way. Which sounded really ominous, but sounds much better than you. I don't know whether that's a poor translation of that one at all. So, again, it's this kind of idea of you're taking these ideas of kind of emotional states, and then you're packaging them up to obviously something that a lot of people are going to demand. I mean, when I worked in Holland and Barr, diet was a big thing, especially seasonally. Just after Christmas, shockingly enough, when everybody wanted to go on a detox and everybody wanted to lose a few pounds, or just before summer. And again, the magazine would kind of reflect that and would have the top five supplements that had been proven or disproven in the year. And this is an absolutely massive industry when it comes to it. And if you read books like Edzard Ernst's book, an awful lot of the slimming ones, I'm not mentioning this one in particular, an awful lot of the swimming ones are quite tenuously based on any kind of scientific research. Follow in that vein. Even more slimming stuff. Shockingly enough, when I worked in the shop, took a lot of these. Citizan is one that I'd never heard of before I worked in the shop. And I remember asking the woman that was my manager at the time, was a very kind of straight down the line, no bull kind of lady. I said to her, so what's the mechanism of that? She said, well, it's kind of in the title. I'm going to spend an awful lot of time on the throne, is the way she put it. It's a marine fibre, and the way it's supposed to work is that it is supposed to bind fat, specifically in your gut. So it comes with a warning because it's supposed to be both saturated and unsaturated fat going to bind them up. So you're supposed to take them a half an hour before you eat, and thus it'll kind of bind up. So even if you eat an entire camembert, this is going to help you not absorb all of that, and you will just excrete it back out. And it is true that Citizan does do that in the test tube, but nobody has actually done the research as to whether or not it does that in your gut or not, or whether whether or not it even stays around in your stomach long enough. These capsules here in particular aren't gastrointestinally resistant, so more than likely you're going to break them up so much in your stomach, especially on an empty stomach, before you eat. So that even if it did have an effect in the stomach, there's not probably going to be enough of it around to mitigate any amount of fat you're going to eat in your diet. These kind of ones, CLA would be another one that's supposed to act in a very similar way. CLA has a little bit more research behind it because the FDA got very concerned with the way that it was being promoted. Again, it was supposed to bind both saturated and unsaturated fats, so they thought it was quite a dangerous thing, especially if you took it over long periods of time, because obviously you'd then not be getting your essential fats and it could lead to disorders and your body would be missing a very key nutrient. So CLA actually comes with warnings in certain states in America, and in some places you can't buy it over the counter. You can still get it here, but it actually will say on the back not to take it for an extended period of time. Again, most of it's laboratory tested, so it's actually not really tested in the real world, or if it is, it's with very small numbers. So whether or not you can extrapolate out even that much is a bit of a push. This is a really popular one. This is a Holland and Barrett special. It's their particular brand. I say it's their particular brand. Most of the ones that are on the shelf are their particular brand, but this is the cheapest one. And it says KLB6. So it's kelp, soy lecithin, and B6 and cider vinegar in there as well. So kelp, as a lot of you might know, is a source of iodine, which is very good for the metabolism. But of course, if you probably already have a particularly low metabolism, you're probably suffering from some sort of thyroid problem, and actually taking more iodine is probably going to exasperate your situation. So the idea of actually being able to boost your metabolism to an extent that would affect your weight would either be exceptionally dangerous because you're going to throw the scales off far too often, or you might be exciting kind of a problem that you might already have. So ionestazine is one that gets an awful lot of traction as well. It's basically, it's one of the plant sterols that people talk about. So it does have some proven action. It's probably not as strong as some people make it out to be by itself, but it's basically, it comes from the soya plant, and it's a fat binder. It's probably not, again, it's not going to shield you from all that camembert you've just eaten, but it will do something to mitigate the problems that you have. But in a weight loss setting, it's a bit of a tenuous link. B6, it's just for energy, as a lot of the B vitamins are purported to be. B6, however, along with all the B vitamins, are water-soluble, and thus, in this kind of format, whether or not you're going to gain a huge amount of benefit from it, because you're going to flush them out of your system very quickly, because this is a capsule. And then cider vinegar is a very old remedy. It's been around for a very long time. It's purported to be good for an awful lot of conditions. Digestion, kind of malaise, if you go back far enough in the literature. And also household cleaning is what you're very good for as well. But it's going to be very, very good for digestion. And again, this kind of idea of fat emulsion. But if you're talking about in your gut, whether you emulsify the fat or not, it's still in there, and your body will probably still process it. 5-HTP, if anybody has paid attention to how natural remedies have been legislated for over the last few years, this one might have come up in your radar. It was taken off the shelves in Ireland in, it was either 2008 or early 2009. And a bit like St. John's Wort is now available prescription only in this country. As a lot of you may know, I'll talk about St. John's Wort in a second, has been shown to be quite effective in some states, and 5-HTP has also similarly been shown to be somewhat effective. It's basically the precursor to serotonin. So if you take it in this form, it's going to be a mood lifter. So it's associated with weight loss, because if you have an emotional attachment to food, if you feel better, if you're less depressed, you might be less inclined to eat. Also for insomnia, that was the main way in which it was sold, so you could get a good night's sleep, especially if it was anxiety-induced insomnia. What was the other one? Also, yeah, obviously travelling. Any kind of anxiety kind of disorder, 5-HTP was very much recommended for. And at the time, it caused an awful lot of consternation, because in 2008, 2009, that EU legislation that came through to start to standardise how all vitamins and minerals and supplements are sold across the EU, and to standardise the legislation, the ball started rolling on that. And I can talk about more about that if people are interested. So basically, in certain countries in the EU, you might know, we would be more strict than the UK. The UK would be more strict than Spain. Nobody's as strict as the Germans. Basically, the Germans, even though they're quite accepting of a lot of natural remedies and homeopathy and naturopathy and things like that, they have very strict views on vitamins and minerals and supplements like this and how they should be sold over the counter, and they wanted to see those things kind of standardised. And 5-HTP was taken off by the Irish Medical Board for kind of reasons of... And it has helped in actually getting it clinically trialled, because one of the side effects of letting Big Pharma, if we want to call it that, let them sell it under their own umbrella, is that they actually will start to instigate trials and they'll see whether it actually does anything. But what I did hear anecdotally from people when I was working there was that this became incredibly expensive if you wanted to get it. It was $35.99 off the shelf anyway, but I heard anecdotes that it was hundreds of euro if you wanted to get it in the prescription form. And again, it's also been linked with gastrointestinal discomfort. In some people who have underlying conditions, it can actually exasperate them quite badly. So if you are under medical supervision taking this, and if you had an underlying condition, at least then you would have something to talk through. If you're taking this, this was one that I held on to for a very long time in my beliefs that it was working for me, to the extent where whenever I went to the UK, because you can still buy it over the shelf, I would buy several bottles of it, and I recently had to throw out an awful lot because it all went off. But I held on to this one for quite some time, but I don't actually know whether, again, if we're talking about the placebo effect, whether it actually did anything for me or not, but I did spend an awful lot of money on that particular one. So we're talking about St. John's Wort. This is one that's lamented an awful lot in this country, because obviously it's been taken off of over-the-counter. You can get it on prescription, but not in your local health food store. Incredibly pixelated image, sorry about that. St. John's Wort has been proven to be somewhat beneficial when it comes to treating mild depression. I wanted to bring this one up because it's an interesting showcase. It was the only one that I could kind of see a difference between the bottles. One thing that people don't realise when they buy supplements is there's a difference between, this is a non-standardised and this is a standardised supplement, and you will generally pay more for the standardised. So you might get, milk thistle is one that I particularly remember, because milk thistle, 300 milligram of milk thistle capsule, about $8.99 for 100. The standardised one was $16.75. There was a huge step up. The difference is that in the standardised one, they're guaranteeing you a certain amount of the active ingredient in each capsule. The other one, they're not. You might get a super dose in one, you might get a very minimal dose in the other. It mightn't be quite as big a difference in that, but that's the kind of the breath range that you're dealing with. But a lot of people don't realise that, but, and you know, rightly so, people want value for money, so quite often they'll go for the standardised one. And even if it has a proven effect, like St. John's wort, you're dealing with something that's very, it's a very broad spectrum as to what you're actually going to be getting a regular daily dose on. This was a big thing. I'm kind of, when I was going through this, I was reflecting on what it was like to work in a health food store rather than on specific youth supplements all the time. And I was talking about how diet and detox supplements were a big thing, or a big seller, basically. And these three also became very popular during my time, specifically hyaluronic acid, because the actress from Desperate Housewives, Terry Hatcher, yeah, she came out and said that this was absolutely fantastic, hyaluronic acid. That's why she looked as fantastic as she did. It wasn't that she had many, many people to make her look that way. Hyaluronic acid is the way to go. And they're kind of connected with pygnotol and grapeseed extract. Pygnotol and grapeseed extract are very similar in that basically bioflavonoids, and that's a very simple word that I'm putting on it because I can't pronounce the very complicated words that are in them. And bioflavonoids are connected with, and they're also antioxidants, which a lot of you would be familiar. It's a buzzword that's out there. Antioxidants basically are meant to help your body mop up free radicals and things like that that are produced through your metabolism, things that can cause mutations and basically the symptoms of aging an awful lot of the time are. So, you know, if you're smoking an awful lot, a lot of people decide, as my best friend who used to work with me in Holland Branch rang me up and said, should I be taking vitamin C, vitamin E, and hyaluronic acid because I still smoke? I said, no, you should give up smoking. That would help much better. These are all connected with preserving your collagen and your skin elasticity and the health of your joints and also the condition of wrinkles and your skin and things like that. So they're very, very popular. And again, very expensive. I took grapeseed extract for a while. I would only ever buy it on sale because it was that expensive. Again, a standardised extract for 30 capsules was $26.99 when I was working there. And 30 capsules was about 15 days worth. So you're burning through quite, and this was kind of towards the end when I was 22 and I had a pill dispenser and no major condition. And I decided this is probably a problem. But it's an interesting kind of how these things become really popular. They come into the consciousness a bit like rescue remedy. You mightn't actually know what's in it or how it works or how it's supposed to work, but because everybody else is taking it, everybody else is doing the leaving cert, everybody else is doing their driving test, is taking it, you decide that it's a really good thing to take. I'm probably going to burn through these really quickly. This was a funny one. or HDW, as it was referred to by furtive men in the counter. Because this was quite expensive per... Well, it used to be. It's not so much anymore. So we used to have one of those empty packets out on the shelf.
It's restricted now.
Is it restricted now?
Yeah.
Aww. That was always our giggle. It's basically horny goat weed. It's called that because supposedly farmers in the foothills of China or Tibet or something like that noticed that the goats would eat this particular herb and then empiricism followed through. So it kind of really didn't send the tin there. Of course, it had nothing to do with the breeding cycles of these animals at all, and it was definitely the weed. But what I noticed between the two of these, I was looking at the British website, I'm sure you're listening to this. I know there's an Irish one, but probably would have noticed that these wouldn't have been on the Irish one, actually. The one for men has maca in it. The one for women is just a complex. But this one was £12.99. This one was
£28.99.
Oh, hey. Don't really know what the difference is. And they were both two for X amount. I know that, I think the women's one did have more stuff in it, but they were very broad ranging things. It was like Agnus Castus and a lot of things that are recommended for PMS and also for menopause as well. So I thought it was a bit kind of I suppose it's broad range. It's appealing to the masses, but this was always, there was a few ones that always gave us a bit of a giggle when we worked. I have to say, you know, we were a bunch of girls working in a shop, so of course we were going to find ways to amuse ourselves. Not many people came in and barefaced asked for this. I'd say a lot of people bought it off the website. But another one that people invested a lot of money in, and I could never understand how it worked, was a supplement called Breast Grow. And I think it's gone. I couldn't find, well, not that I was too interested in Googling the words breast grow, without the W, but just in case, Google filled it in for me. And it was at the time, it was promoted by Rosanna Davidson, you know, demonstrating how her cup size had gone up. It looked like a push-up bra to me. But breast grow was basically, as far as I could make out, it was things like barley and wheat and things. There's nothing substantive in it. It looked like whole grains in a tablet for $72.99 for a month. Again, it got very popular because she was promoting it. It got a lot of press, things like that. And that's kind of what I'm talking about. Like, I'm not so much. I mean, I don't take any supplements anymore at all. I've pretty much given up on all of them. I don't even take multivitamin anymore. But it's not so much the supplements that bother me. It's really the way in which they're sold. And I think especially kind of branding them male and female and having such a large price discrepancy does bother me on a fundamental level. You can flip. This one I find really interesting. And again, when I was working in the shop, I didn't really understand the differences. There's royal jelly, there's propolis, there's bee pollen, there's manuka honey, there's all the different types of honeys that you can get from bees that are exposed to different types of plants, basically. Manuka honey is the one that, where it's exposed to the tea tree plant in particular. And that has a certain amount of kind of trial evidence behind it. But I was listening to somebody talk about these kind of products in the past, and he said, what is our obsession with bee goo? Every form of goo that bees produce, we think it's fantastic. Royal jelly is kind of, it sounds slightly more, you know, okay, it's up there with honey, it's the stuff that they give to the queen. So, okay, that sounds okay. Bee propolis is the stuff that they use to make the hive. You know, it's sap and kind of stuff that the workers make. Like, it's not. I used to take propolis for a sore throat. I felt quite unwell when I read what bee propolis was. Bee propolis, along with all the different honeys and things like that, obviously can be quite dangerous for people who might have allergies to certain plants and saps and things like that. They often come with a warning on the back of it if you're allergic to certain plants. You should probably stay away from this because we can't verify what exactly is going to be in it. A bit like the bee pollen. Bee pollen is basically pollen that bees have brought into the hive and kind of sorted and dusted down and decided that they wanted to keep. So you don't actually know where it's coming from. You know, they say bee pollen, the bees haven't produced it, they've just collected it, so you don't actually know where it's coming from. And a lot of these claims, I found a particularly good website. I didn't actually write it into the book. It was bioethicsireland.ie, and he had a fantastic, he actually writes for the Irish Times quite often. He'll do kind of a breakdown of these kind of sensations that break every so often, and he says that with all of these bee products, apart from manuka honey, which got an awful lot of press a few years ago, there's nothing to back them up. It's all folk memory, basically. So none of these things have borne out. They're generally kind of for energy or to fight off colds. They're very kind of generic, you know, kind of airy-fairy kind of ideas of what they're supposed to do. This one captured my imagination. Bee venom. This was a new one on me as well, but this is on the Holland & Barrett website, and bee products. And Manuka has kind of spawned a whole industry of bee-related products. And bee venom, apparently, especially in Europe, in Asia, kind of in China and Russia, is very much seen as kind of a cure-all. It's kind of a salve for an awful lot of things, so both internally and externally. But these products are face washes and they're masks and they're things like that. And they're supposed to be regenerative. I don't really understand. There doesn't seem to be any kind of. There's no mechanism explained. I don't know how exactly bee venom on your face is supposed to be a good thing. With the manuka honey, you may have noticed enough love and had this thing, UMF, written on all of them. And that's a unique manuka factor. So that's kind of a measurement that the industry themselves have put on their products. So when you have, I mean, they do actually mean something, and if you actually crack open a pot of honey, if you have like a plus 15 and a plus 30, they do look a lot denser, they tend to taste a lot stronger. So I don't know whether they're dehydrating the honey to a point where they're taking out an awful lot more of the liquid so that it actually becomes a more concentrated substance. And as I said, anecdotally, and kind of in very small trials, Manuka honey has been very good for people who are suffering with bed sores and things like that. Basically to work as a, I'm going to forget the word now.
Ulcers.
But you know when you put something on top of something?
Salve.
Kind of a...
Poultice.
That's it. If you're trying to keep... If it's a wound that you want to keep wet, basically, they're meant to work particularly well. So in hospital settings, a lot of nurses when I was working in Holland Bar would have bought Manuka honey because they said anecdotally they would have seemed as quite good. This one's slightly more disgusting. So D2N is another company that Holland & Barrett own, and that's what they train under in the Netherlands. And I'm ashamed to say I put this on my face. Basically, this particular I can't remember what it's domestically called. This particular species of snail, and I presume all snails have the same mechanism, but they discovered, I think this one is slightly more mucousy than the rest of them, but they decided that because these snails were so good at producing this mucus themselves that they would use to repair their shell, that mechanism would work on your face. And that was basically it. That was the connection that was made. And when this first came in, it was just an expensive face cream, to be honest, with as everybody knows a little bit of science thrown into it, but it is a gel, and I don't actually know how much of the actual gel itself is supposed to be straight from the snail. But again, it was $28.99 for a relatively small little pot, and it's still there, and it still gets a certain amount of press every so often. But I haven't seen anything that actually has proven or disproven. I think the price has come down considerably, but it's this idea of, and my sister absolutely hates this, but she's older than me, so. She's had more time to get angry about face creams than I have, I think. She said, if you're putting it on your face, it's probably not going to do much for you. We go back to the idea of the pycnogenol and the grapeseed extract and things like that, and you're trying to strengthen your collagen from the inside. Your collagen is further down in your skin. Probably putting something on your face isn't going to do a huge amount. But I did, anecdotally, I have to say, it did help with certain patches of my eczema, but who knows whether they were going to improve anyway. I'm fast running out of time. Okay, I was chatting earlier actually about how, I find a lot of alternative therapies can be very interesting, and as we know, an awful lot of what we have in medicine these days, aspirin and things like that started off as natural medicine. We just isolated the part of it that worked, and we now just use that bit as opposed to chewing on bits of willow bark and things like that. So an awful lot of these things do have a certain amount of research behind them, and some only have a kernel of truth behind them. And so some of them are actually genuinely scary, and I have, especially when I was working in the shop, I did have a lot of people come into me and kind of confess things that they were doing. Like, I had one woman who came into me during the height of the fish oil craze, and she told me that she was taking 30 500 milligram capsules of fish oil every day with her breakfast. And she said they were disgusting, and she absolutely hated taking them, because these were, 500 milligrams, that's a big capsule. So she was taking a capsule, having a spoonful of cereal, taking a capsule, having a spoonful of cereal. So there's this kind of idea that because things are natural, they're good for you, therefore lots of them are going to be better for you. And if you do subscribe to the belief that these things do have a physiological effect on you, then a bit like taking an overdose of paracetamol, they're going to have a negative effect if you take too much. And there just seems to be this cognitive dissonance where people think that it's natural, therefore it's good, so it can't do me any harm. One of the things I was talking about earlier was there's a very small list of things that you definitely can't talk about in the shop. So if somebody came up to you and said, I have cancer, I have glaucoma, I have type 1 diabetes, I have kidney failure, they were kind of red flags. So I'm sorry, I can't recommend you anything, because that's just putting somebody in danger. That you have a condition that's so serious that you have to talk to your doctor, there's nothing we can do for you here. And these two in particular have been linked with attempting to treat not type 1 diabetes, but type 2 diabetes, to delay the offset of it. Cinnamon is also what they call kind of a thermogenic herb. It's supposed to be quite warming. It's a bit like capsaicin and things like that. It's supposed to help with circulation. And chromium has been linked with, it's a trace mineral that you do get in your diet, and it's been linked with balancing your sugar levels. And I did come across one or two people that were very seriously considering, having been told that they were on the road to developing diabetes, that were considering shutting all medical intervention and going fully with these. And these things really haven't been trialled properly in the general population. Whether or not they would actually do anything for you, especially without medical supervision, is quite iffy. And I just, that was the one thing that kind of stunned me as somebody who was only 21, 22, working in a shop, wearing a green t-shirt, with a badge that admittedly did say advanced product sale on it. Because in Holland and Barth they make you do exams. I forgot to mention that earlier. You do exams and you start off as just a sales assistant and you make your way up. Advanced product sales is as far as, you know, it's kind of the pinnacle, if you will. And it means that you've done certain exams and things, but these are in-house exams, obviously they mean nothing in the real world. But because you're stood in a shop that looks vaguely like a pharmacy and you're selling this stuff, the people put a certain amount of cachet into that. But I never studied medicine, I never studied science beyond biology in school. So I was my guess sometimes could be as good as yours, and yet people would put an awful lot of... And people would come in and talk to you about things, and you would ask them whether they'd ever mentioned it to their GP, and they'd say, no, I'd be too embarrassed. But you're okay to come into a shop and tell a complete stranger, and obviously they are, because if they were that embarrassed, they'd never have to come back and talk to me again. So that was kind of the... You know, Holland and Barrett are doing their thing, they're selling their products and things like that. And I don't think anybody... I mean, I know my managers and the sales reps and things like that never really questioned it in these ways. It's a job. You're selling stuff. It's a shop like any shop. You have goals to meet and things like that. So you have links selling, and, you know, if somebody comes in and buys a supplement for, you know, if they want a laxative, you sell them the laxative tea as well, because you want them to buy as much as possible within the shop, and you'll offer them the magazine as well. So it's not... Oliver is kind of a bad example, I suppose, because it's seen as the Walmart of those shops. It's seen as kind of the big bad wolf, and it's seen as pushing out an awful lot of Irish business in that way, and a lot of kind of family-run shops. But it is in the business of making money, and I think people sometimes forget that when they're asking for advice. This was a new one as well. Really pixelated. Another thing that I just thought I'd leave you with is... I will always leave room for a certain amount of... I'll look into something before I say that I won't take it. You know, if something new came out tomorrow that said it dramatically reduced the instance of people with migraine in, you know, in the 25 to 45 bracket, I'd probably look into it, and I'd look into it substantively. But I'm always wary of things that say that they're good for lots and lots of things, because that probably means that they're stretching too far. And aloe vera is one of those ones. And aloe vera is purported to be good for an awful lot of things, both topically and... to take internally. And as somebody who suffered from a mild form of IBS most of my life, aloe vera was one that I took quite religiously when I worked in the shop. Now, when I looked into the mechanism, it's actually quite scary. When they look into how aloe vera works in the intestine, I'm just like leaving this warning because everybody's thinking about taking it, it irritates the lining of your intestine. It doesn't actually stimulate it as it usually, but it irritates it, and it actually encourages your intestinal wall to give out water and electrolytes. So if you're somebody who's prone to dehydration or maybe may suffer from nausea an awful lot if you have the associated IBS symptoms, this can actually be quite a dangerous thing to take. And the FDA in America in 2002 banned the use of the sale of aloe vera as a laxative or as an internal drink. And that's something it's quite well accepted in this country. I think a lot of people who might have a very delicate digestive problem that they're trying to cope with, that's definitely not the way to go. And again, it's sold for everything. This is a very new product, one best product of the show last year. It's basically something that you slather on the inside of your nose. It's meant to be good for relieving hay fever. I've never suffered from hay fever. I don't know whether that would be a good thing or not. But I think if my nose is really sore in the first place, I don't know if I'd want to go whipping around with it with a ban. But again, it's meant to be good for children. To be honest, if you're putting a ban into your nose, you're suppressing all the nasal hairs in your nose. They're supposed to catch all that dirt and pollen and things like that. So I don't know how well that works, but if you come across something that says that it can deal with such a broad swath of things, I'd advise you to kind of look at it again and wonder, you know, what exactly are they basing this upon? Is it complete folk memory, or is there something to it? And it's a really good resource, because as I said, As I said, I'm not a scientist, never studied medicine. This is an absolutely fantastic, it's on a website, go ahead, finishing soon, don't worry. It's an absolutely fantastic website called Information is Beautiful. And they have interactive graphics. And this one is called Snake Oil or Science. And you can see here, worth it line, you can see our new friend on the viewers down there, he's passed it. So the size of the circle shows how much kind of evidence there is behind it, kind of promising evidence that there is, or the amount of people who've looked into it, or the colour it is, and the size then is its popularity, how many people do them for it. And all of these, the scientific information behind this graphic is drawn from PubMed. So the guy has developed an algorithm that pulls all the data from PubMed and then displays it for people who are never going to read a scientific paper, like me. And basically, and when you go into the actual, it's an interactive graphic, and you can click on them and it'll tell you what, say with the valerians, that says sleep anxiety, and it'll probably point you to the data that it's pulling from, whether or not that's a reliable source or not. So I found that one really quite good, and again, bioethicsireland.ie, I found a very good, very easy to read blog, if you're around. He has an A to Z of all the different supplements that he's kind of looked at, going back chronologically. So if you're wondering what happens to a person who worked in a health food store, 3.5 years of study graphic design, it's so much shocking. I work in the Natural History Museum. So that's me looking very unimpressed. I do that a lot in photographs, it turns out. This is just before we opened the Natural History Museum again, April 2010. So you can see there's a lot of bubble wrap and stuff on the floors. And that was the third time we had taken that out of the cabinet. me and Adam were about fit to burst at that point. But he looked quite happy about the situation. So it came good in the end. So what I found in Belfast was people had questions, so I'm happy to talk to any particular supplement. Like I said, I stopped working at Holland Barrett in 2008, so that's kind of when my hands-on experience of these things stopped. So a lot of the very current stuff I probably wouldn't have a huge amount of current information on, but I hope we got something from it.
Really interesting slide to finish on. Given the
you're just trying to make us jealous.
The rhino horn that they had to take from the because of the amount of properties associated.
I don't even know where they've gone. Yeah, it was in the atmosphere of a tiger raid in the museum. If you go in, I don't know if many of you have been. I've actually never been in the museum until I was in college. We were brought there for a field trip. There's two rhinos on display, full amounts. Like, all the heads were taken away because they're quite easy to take down. But there's two big rhinos, and they're kind of back to back. And they're both now missing their noses, for want of a better word. Like, they were taken out, and they were moved off display, and only a handful of people know where they are. Because people were, yeah, all the tear gas and things like that was going around, people got very worried. Nobody's after the maimed wolf.
They had a problem with people stealing the fake ones, and they had signs put up saying, these are fake. Don't
point to you. There is an argument to just leaving them, and you know, if you think about it, you're kind of making a statement that these things had to be taken away. But the funny thing is with rhino horn, it's keratin. You would get just as much benefit from the sweepings of a barber shop floor than you do from rhino horn.
You're killing rhinos. It's
weight for weight. It's going for way more than gold and rhinos. Yeah.
Can I ask you, what was the proportion of men versus women who were your customers?
It would have been mostly women.
Mostly men?
Yeah. But what I found when men did tend to go, and actually want to talk to you, they tended to have things that they were quite willingly telling you that they wouldn't bring up with their GP. So it tended to be, what a lot of people came in were kind of day-to-day kind of things like digestive problems. A lot of people suffer from them, and men in particular would be very, very embarrassed about it and quite sheepish. Or, like I said, with the horny goby, it would be sexual problems as well, and they wouldn't necessarily want to talk to. But you would get a lot of henpecked men that would come in, kind of being ushered in to buy their garlic or their fish oils, or you're buying that now, Bob. Or being, you know, going into the list. Right. And people of a certain age as well, you know, it'd be kind of dependent on the age, what they were going for. But yeah, definitely women, broad swaths women across the ages, definitely.
And why do you think people are so reluctant to talk to their GP, and that they would talk to you? By my standards, a young girl, untrained, and I'm not being rude or anything.
No, it's true.
And they're quite happy to tell you their most intimate details, but their GP, whom they have known for years, they're afraid to talk to him.
That's what I really couldn't get over, and I think a lot of people, and it does seem to come out in the research, because I'm quite interested in that, obviously, having to deal with it on a day-to-day basis, and it seems to be, A, people are afraid of wasting their GP's time. They think that their GP's time is precious, and that they're taking it up by coming in with small conditions, or they wait to build up a few small conditions until they become fully blown or become quite serious. And a lot of people are just genuinely embarrassed. I mean, I'm from Carlow, and a lot of people would have known the local GP from their 20s, and he's part of the community, and to a certain extent he was always going to be professional, but there's a certain element of admitting things to people that people are going to be quite ashamed of, especially when it comes to things like anxiety or depression or things that might have certain social stigma. It can be very difficult to talk about. And also some GPs are just... My GP growing up was not a particularly empathetic man.
Yeah.
He's not easy to talk to. You know, if you mentioned the depression word around him, it wasn't going to go down very well. He was going to hand you a subscription or prescription for something.
And you can with the fee as well.
Yeah, and increasingly, yes, it's obviously money. But that was the most stunning thing about it. And my friend Sue, who's still my best friend, we met when we were working in Hollenburg. The worst thing seemed to happen to her. I got some interesting customers when I was working there. There was a guy who was obsessed with 5-HTP that would have you on the phone for hours telling you about the conspiracy of Big Pharma. There were certain days where we just wouldn't want to pick up the phone because we knew he'd be home and he'd be ringing us to tell us the latest news about it. But Sue actually had a young guy at one point, and he came in and he literally dropped his trousers. And Sue kind of, whoa! And he went, do you know what that is? And Sue went, does your girlfriend suffer from cold sores at all? And, you know, it's this level of people thinking that, this is an appropriate thing to do in a shop, and B, that you're an appropriate person to talk to, a very intimate thing like that. Obviously, there's a certain amount of ignorance coming into play there, but that was the worst thing that ever happened, yeah.
Thank you.
Probably weren't expecting that kind of answer. Yeah. That's the worst story that I have.
Did you have doubts about the stuff long before you left, or did you have doubts and sort of say, this is not for me, I'm not available for 2 weeks?
I left because I finished college and I got that job, pretty much. I didn't really actually think about it. I think I'd become cynical as opposed to sceptical the longer I've been there, because I started to see the trends of things coming up over and over again. You know, new research points to small beneficial effect of X, and Healthy is a relatively good magazine because we promote things based on very kind of loose amounts of information. And it was actually only when I was working with this guy Adam actually got me into what we call scepticism. He got me listening to a podcast called The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, one of the podcasters is a neurologist. And you can write, you know, it's a very popular podcast, so if you're very lucky, they might read out one of your letters. And I think Adam kind of thought that I was still, I mean, at that time I was still taking multivitamins, and I would still go in and chat to my friends that were still in the shop, and I would still buy a certain amount. And I think he was kind of concerned that I don't get paid a huge amount to do this, and I was, you know, kind of throwing good money after bad with these things. So it was a very slow, gradual progress. I didn't just wake up one day and have a eureka moment. But it was things like when I worked in the shop, nobody ever explained to me the mechanism behind homeopathy. I sold it, nobody ever explained it to me. Same with the bacteriology. Sorry.
Just one other question. You seem to kind of work your way through the shop with the amount of stuff that you took. Did you ever feel any of it did you any good?
Honestly, no. No. I would probably never take... especially for the conditions that I was attempting to treat, the likes of eczema and you know, mild irritable bowel and things like that. No, I probably wouldn't. My friend Sue, whenever she thinks about taking these things again, she always rings me, and I think it's just to get me to put her off buying these things. Even when it comes down to vitamins and minerals, you really have to be eating a devastatingly bad diet to need an awful lot of these things. And when you're talking about the antioxidants and things like that, there's very little research that actually shows that you're better off eating your 5 to 8 fruit and veg a day rather than taking it in supplement form. And I would kind of subscribe to that. I would rather make the effort with my diet and my lifestyle and get a bit of exercise and, you know, use certain creams, and I absolutely have to, and, you know, use medical intervention when I, you know, get to that point rather than It's just trial and error an awful lot of the time. And they tell you that. And, you know, when you're selling these things, you do sell that idea to people as well. Well, it works for some people, or it may help. And people seem to be okay with that, and I'm not okay with that anymore, basically. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Do Holland and Barrett carry out clinical trials? Or?
Not as far as I know. No, they're purely a retail. And as far as I know, NBTY don't either. They just produce them.
Are they obliged to?
No.
They don't. Yeah, they, it's alternative medicines, which, or it's in America they're referred to as, and I think because it would be the same packaging an awful lot of the time, they're referred to as food supplements, so they fall outside the idea of medicine. And if you read their website, it's all maybes, ifs, buts. It's never this will cure X. It's always this may help with, has been reported to aid with. They never really make a substantive claim. And we were instructed, especially with certain supplements, not to make concrete claims that these things would work, but at the same time trying to sell something in the largest quantity of it. They're a retail chain, they have no...
So the Advertising Standards Authority can't do anything about some of the claims they make?
They can do, if you think a wording is particularly dubious, if you think they really are overstretching it, with the likes of the homeopathic company that Colin was talking about earlier. And there has been a huge drive in the UK, especially with the likes of Boots and places like that, to really get them to pull up their bootstraps when it comes to selling these things. And a lot of the claims have been successful. But it just means, I mean, Boots is owned by the same Carlyle Group. They just change their wording and they keep on selling it. And they just make the wording slightly less substantive, basically.
I'm saying that the Advertising Standards Authority of Ireland are very, very weak. It can be an exercise in total frustration bringing something up with the Advertising Standards Authority of Ireland. It's worth doing though. It's one thing I think that if they get the message loud and clear,
you can query with the Irish Medical Board.
Yeah,
they're quite good at being into. I think that's why certain things like have been taken off the shelves. Certain high dosages of vitamins and things like that, because people have complained of adverse side effects, or they've queried why these things are available over the counter. And they have stepped in, and they do have a section on their website dealing with alternative therapies and supplements. Yeah.
And there's another law going through the European Parliament at the moment that's going to ban an awful lot of alternative supplements. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of loopholes, of course. This doesn't mean that every health food shop in the country is going to close down, but there's going to be a wider range of restrictions. And we've got people like Marion Harkin, MEP up in the North East, who's fighting tooth and nail to try and allow as many alternative medicines and supplements in as possible.
Well, they're at the party too late, because that was that legislation that was brought, the European-wide legislation that was brought through.
That's the same one.
I started working in Holland, I said 2008, no, it was 2005 when I started working in Holland, and that was when the EU brought together the committee that was going to start looking at this. And the UK had already been fighting that for about a decade, because the EU had been grumbling about it for that long, and that was when Ireland these groups started putting together petitions and things like that, and they were at the party too late. These wheels had already started turning long before anybody thought about it. And I was in the shop 6 months and somebody came in and said, I'm surprised you're still open. I thought every shop in the country would be closed down. But a lot of it is, the Germans in particular don't want you to be able to buy anything above the recommended daily allowance of something. So say the likes of 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C, gone. You know, any kind of mega dose of something is going to be off sale, and an awful lot of remedy. If something doesn't have a traditional use, that was the way that they worded it. If something has been around for, I think it's 15 plus years, 30. It's a 30, yeah. It's 30 plus years, that's seen as traditional, so that'll be fine. Anything newer than that has to prove it through clinical trials, and homeopathy gets a free pass because it's seen as not being any kind of therapy at all.
They still have to buy a license, though, for each individual product. Yeah.
It makes it a lot more, what a lot of people in that kind of community are saying is actually people are grumbling because they say it's going to push small businesses out of business. But there's very few small businesses making supplements like this. An awful lot of them are, if you go back, they are an arm of a very large pharmaceutical company because it's another way of making money. And they've bought out the rights for, like Pycnogenol is a copyrighted registered term. An awful lot of these ones that you come across are owned by some people with proprietary rights.
You seem to speak really like nicely about your time in Holland Barrett, and you don't really seem to have felt that there was any kind of any suppression or anything while you were there. Yet you pointed out yourself that it is laid out like pharmacy. It's meant to feel, and people did feel like you were professionals in training. Like, looking at it now, do you feel that there was any kind of, you know, hush hush, don't ask how the mechanism works, or don't question the doses, or like stuff like St. John's Wort that have side effects that, you know, have been proven that they can be very dangerous, that now do you feel that, like, there kind of was a thing of don't ask questions?
I honestly think the kind of people who work in health food stores, like myself, didn't question it. It didn't occur to you.
Yeah.
If you're going to work in a shop like that, more than likely you're going to accept it at face value when you go in. And I don't think anybody, like I said before, I don't think anybody in Holland and Barrett is doing it. Nobody's doing it malevolently.
Yeah.
You know, whoever is selling you these things genuinely thinks that they're doing you some good and will attempt to look into the literature as much as anybody can. You know, we had information points and books and things like that behind the counter, but even looking back on that, some of the books that we had as reference materials would be kind of... There'd be people that I would seriously not consider. We had Gillian McKeith books when she was still a doctor, and they were signed with love and light, Dr. Gillian. But I didn't. I do have very good feeling for when I worked there, and I think it was just that none of us thought to question it, and there was no element of hush hush. And like I said, with healthy, if something did come out with a side effect, they would put it in there. And it was kind of seen in this kind of acknowledgement of these things. And things have come on and off the shelves, things like Cava Cava and horny goat meat and things like that in the home. Barrett always comply. And they never, if you go into one of their UK stores, you can get massively higher doses of vitamins and minerals that you can buy over here. And they just comply with it. They have absolutely no problem with that. I don't think it's suppression. I think it's just, it's everybody who works there accepts it. They have no reason to not accept it. But again, people would come in from each spectrum. You would have people that would come in that, in my eyes, would believe in it too much, to the extent where they would reject everything, even going to a doctor. And then you would get people that would be slightly more, I suppose, sceptical and would actually have a conversation with you about it. And most people are in between. They just want good information. I once or twice, I won't say which manager it was, did say to me that, you know, I probably would have sent that person to their pharmacist. You know, I was kind of quick to kind of say, look, you might want to chat. You know, we were always told to ask if you're on medications or if you have an underlying condition and things like that. That was standard. But you kind of, sometimes you'd have to have a conversation with somebody before they'd admit that to you. Or the reason that St. John's Wort was taken off over the counter in this Ireland, the official reason by the Irish Medical Board was that it interferes with the contraceptive pill. And if you asked a woman in the shop, are you on any medications? Oh, no. Are you on the pill? Oh, yeah. Such as a Smartie you take once a day. People have very strange interpretations of what they consider medication, so that was a grey area, definitely. Yeah.
Could I just ask about your opinion on herbal teas and that whole area? Because they're coming down to supermarkets as well, and the book, like green tea and white tea, they have fantastic properties. What's your view?
I like a lot of them. Again, that was something that I bought compulsively when I worked in the shop every time they went on offer. Generally, the therapeutic level of a tea is going to be very low. There are certain ones that I would probably have certain truck with, like nettle, because it actually does contain a naturally occurring substance that helps you excrete uric acid that can build up if you have arthritis and things like that. And green tea and white tea are going to be quite good for you. They do contain a certain amount of caffeine, and they will contain a certain amount of antioxidants, but probably not as much as people are making them out to have. And, you know, if you're trying to limit your caffeine intake or you want to try something a little bit different, I have no problem with them. They are becoming, like you said, they are becoming incredibly mainstream. Generally, some of the more medicinal ones that actually may have an effect taste awful. I can live with that. No, there's one particular brand, Dr. Stewart's, and they put together horrendous combinations of things. It's like slippery elm and burdock and also and like a little bit of peppermint to try and take off the edge. That's just horrible. So the ones that truly might have an effect, a tiny effect, probably, you wouldn't drink willingly, to be honest.
But I think
Or is there a bit of like that, that they want the church to get in the supermarket, they're like the leftovers of the real stuff sometimes. Because I remember buying once a tea that was said white tea, and then you turn the box, read it, and it's basically black tea with a bit of white tea or something like that.
Well, it's the same plant, yeah. The black tea is the oldest.
Same
tea. Yeah,
exactly.
The white tea is the very oldest.
But
it's
black tea with a bit of butts, basically.
Yeah.
White tea.
You do get this, green tea with everything in it. Yeah, it's, there is a big thing of throwing the little bit of what's good into it. Personally, I thought white tea tasted like nothing. If you actually get pure white tea, it doesn't really taste of anything at all. It's not a very exciting one. But I have taken, again, you don't know whether it's just it's the placebo effect. Like, I've taken the sleep easy teas and things like that. But you're taking a hot drink with a bit of honey in it. It's probably going to make you feel better anyway. The ones for sore throats and things like that are for warming up in a winter's evening if they have cinnamon in it. The yogi teas are quite pleasant. I still drink those. I still quite like those.
I'm just amazed that people are willing to believe these things so easily. Anything that's brought out on the market, people will say, oh yeah, that's worth trying. I just can't believe people's gold.
Well, a lot of these things have been around for a very long time. And they have gotten into the cultural consciousness. And it's very...
There's nail gel, though.
That was not that really was not, and I did wait until it was on sale before I bought it. People love anecdote. If I was back in the day when I was selling these things and I really thought something was going to help somebody, anecdote was always the best way to go. Say that it worked really well for you, or it worked really well for your best friend, and you might genuinely be telling the truth. Like, when it came to the menopause stuff, I didn't talk about any of the ladies' issues. It's a big aisle in any health food shop. All the oils and things like that. But there's flash fighters in Holland and Barrett, and it's a kind of combination of a load of different things. And my boss at the time was taking them, and she swore by them. Her and her best friend absolutely swore by them. So if anybody was on the fence about it, you'd say, well, my manager swears by them. And people go, oh okay. Mm-hmm. If somebody else says it, it's good for them. And especially with the celebrity endorsement. If it's somebody who's seen as a bit of a celebrity darling, people would pile on top of it. When Katie Price, when Jordan was having her last baby, she advocated homeopathic remedies. There was a whole set that you could get from Nelson's, kind of a pregnancy recovery set, and we didn't sell it. And every single day I was sending about 20 people down to the homeopathic dispensary down the street, because people just love something that has a little anecdote attached to it. Because when you think about it, science and statistics and placebo trials and double blind and things like that, they don't mean anything to most people. People don't understand the impact of these things. You know, a guy in a white suit, or you know, in a white jacket, telling you that this is really good for you or is not really good for you, is not the same as somebody that you recognise from the media or your friend telling you this has worked really well for them. You like that kind of personal connection, and it's a very basic human interaction. Basically, like somebody testing the poison for you a lot of the time.
It's been incredible though, because it's like when you actually bought the test of medicine, and I told you, now let's enroll in the trial. I don't know what you're getting, I don't know what the effects are going to be, I don't know what can happen to you. You probably say, oh no, thanks very much, I'm not going for that. But if you know, you sell something like this, you say, look, I actually don't know what it does, like basically, generally, the people still go for it.
Yeah,
I'm not even a bit scared that, oh my god. No.
Well, some people, if somebody had never been into a health food store before, you know, had never taken vitamin C or had never taken echinacea, they would be genuinely skeptical. And you would have people who would just go, actually, no, it's not for me. Like, not everybody came in and went, yes, please, I'll have the biggest one that you have. But, people would go, you know, they'd be a bit guarded, and they'd buy the smallest amount they had of it and things like that. They'd give it a go, though, a lot of people, especially if it was... Groups of women would often come in, and one woman was the crusader and said, this has really worked for me, and everybody else had to buy one. And you usually have one who was sheepishly buying the 30 quietly, you know, the 30 capsules. I'll try it, we'll see how it goes. But it's just a societal pressure, I think, an awful lot of the time. And it is also a rejection of how much mainstream medicine can cost an awful lot of the time.
You also have people like Patrick Holford, and you know, they appear up in the Late Late Show. So that's a huge endorsement for the whole industry. And somebody with name recognition has got books all over the place, you know, advocating vitamin pills for pretty much everything. You know. So you consistently kind of in some ways fighting that, saying, well, you know, vitamin pills are not as brilliant as you might think they are, you know, so it's a big problem.
Because in real sense, how people don't even understand the ways behind it. It's like you take vitamin C, and like if you know a small bit about biochemistry or something like that, everything that is not needed would be excreted in your urine. So you're pretty much just stuffing yourself with something that won't even stay around for too long.
There's also the argument that the ones that are synthesized, your body doesn't really interact with them anyway, so create a bit. And the company that owns Home Bar do own Ester C, the trademark for that, which is supposed to be the more natural vitamin C, so you're meant to be better able to absorb it. But you are taking them in massive doses, and that's... Whenever we used to sell, especially vitamin B complexes, people, you'd have to warn them that their pee would turn really yellow. Because, you would flush that really quick. You can get time release of these things, and I obviously I'm not a biochemist, so I don't understand how these things work, but an awful lot of the time, the idea behind it works. Like there is a correlation there, but whether or not it works in the manner in which you're applying it is the question. A bit like taking a big notch and things like that. Whether or not taking them in massive doses or eating a few more apples is going to do you more benefit, basically. Mm-hmm.
I think it's fascinating, though. You're one who was taking 35 of the fish oil. It's like you wouldn't take 35 of any pill. You just wouldn't. Nobody would do that. But the mentality behind people thinking, well, it can't hurt me because it's natural, or and that, like, okay, if you're taking homeopathic sugar pills or whatever, but like, you know, they're too much of anything. You know,
that's one of the main things that people just seem to think that it's only ever going to do you good, and that would be a big issue, especially with any kind of fish oil. It's got to have vitamin E, all the water, the fat soluble ones, the ones that you can hang on to in your liver. And if you continuously, if you had a low level. You'd sneak out. if you had a low level liver condition that you had no idea that you had, and you're suddenly exasperating a very important organ that way. But people, again, I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding of how your body works as well. It probably comes down to education at the end of the day, like whether or not people actually understand how these things work, and that if it is going to have that physiological effect, it can equally have a negative effect. I don't know how many times I had that conversation with people about garlic, because garlic acts as a blood thinner, regardless of whether or not it does anything else that it's purported to do, like antifungal and things like that. But it's definitely a blood thinner, and you shouldn't take it if you're on morphine. But I would have arguments with people that say, no, but you'd be grand. No, you really shouldn't take it, to the point where there's a few people that I just refused to service. And they said, well, I'll go somewhere else. I said, well, it'll be on their head then, because I've told you the best information that I have. And yeah, people just seem to think because it was natural, it couldn't possibly do you any harm. The fish oils were actually very, very popular with the Chinese community in Dublin. And there, you kind of wonder whether it's doing a bit of good, because they would buy them in huge bulk. And I asked one of them at one point, I said, why do you buy so many of these things? They would buy the 500 capsules. They said, we're from central China, and our parents have no access to fresh fish. And this is the best thing that we can send to them. So they would just buy acres of this stuff and send it back to them. Mm-hmm. And when you think about fish oils, they're one of the least kind of tampered with things. So in that kind of, I kind of give them that. Like, I'd have no problem with that, because you genuinely are serving a deficient diet. Like I said before, unless your diet is really, really, really terrible, you're probably not going to need these things. But those kind of things you can't really argue with. And you just hope that they're not taking 35 a day. Apart from anything, that's really going to hurt your stomach after a while. Yeah, I mean, I could never take fish oil because it always repeated on me anyway.
You know, gelatine.
Yeah. That's a lot of people are very... A lot of people don't realise that a lot of people are very sensitive to what... Not so much the capsules, but the tablets. The cellulose in which tablets are made of. A lot of people have a very adverse digestive reaction to those. Especially glucosamine, because they tend to be very large tablets. And a lot of people would have very intense pain if they took too many of them. And that's something that people don't know, they aren't always warned about, because you are ingesting an awful lot of hollow fibre, basically, which can cause an awful lot of problems. The larger the tablet you take, the more likely that is to happen, basically.
But Rebecca, don't you think there's a lot to be said for the eons of history that have gone before, you know, pharma and medical response to our conditions, and the centre that would have been held maybe with, you know, maybe a woman in the community, or a response to, you know, something needed outside of a healthy diet in responding to that, and how, okay, obviously it's been exploited.
Yeah.
But how that still sits very much as a strong place to go to and as a connection.
Well, I think that's why people go to it. It's a cultural thing.
But I think isn't it more than just that folkloric memory that you're talking about? Isn't there validity to it?
If you were to watch,
the validity to the food.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, there are people that take that too far and say that food can cure everything. I think the problem with these allowing a little bit of leeway with these things is that people will take as much rope as they need to hang themselves, and you get people like the couple in Australia who allowed their child to die of eczema because they refused to treat it with anything other than
the placebo.
Jehovah's
to the blood transfusion.
Well, yeah, they only went with homeopathy, and the child succumbed to a chronic skin infection. That's why she died. The video that Colin mentioned earlier, the storm beat poem, is very, and Dara Breen says this all the time. He said, yes, we had herbal medicine, and then we looked at what worked in it, and now we have medicine.
That's true. The aspirin.
Yeah. And that's why we still find things. That's why we still find things that work. Because, for a long time we didn't know what it was in Willow Bark that worked. And there are certain substances that are still like that.
There's a lot of fear and power then, withholding, you know, that amount of information to the central, knowledgeable.
I think the problem comes in is where, if you're doing it in like a herbal, over-the-counter kind of way, people feel like they understand why it's working. Whereas once you take it out of that system, then it goes into language that people can no longer understand, and that's why people get scared of it. And that's absolutely fine, because, you know, it's a bit, you know, doctors will often tell you that this should work, or, you know, you start reading the adverse effects on your medication, you go, oh, I'm going to die. Seizures, dizziness, bleeding, all sorts of harm. And these are these things that could happen in millions of people, but there is a tiny infinitesimal chance. And once you start introducing those things into the conversation, people get very scared. What they want is somebody that they know that will say this will work. You just hand them the salve or the balm or whatever it is, whatever you're looking at. I just think
that there's a huge amount to be said for personal knowledge about this. We were in a situation maybe 2 years back where by a reaction to ibuprofen or penicillin, we're not yet, I don't think we'll ever be sure of what it was, we nearly lost our daughter to a very simple condition that this was the prescribed response to. Now, I wouldn't be one to buy into antibiotics on a regular basis anyway, but it was just shocking to see that this was a potential response, not even subscribed to in the small print, to something so easily accessible.
Well, it's just because you're just very unlucky to be that tiny, tiny percentile.
Absolutely.
But there are people who have equally had reactions like that to over-the-counter stuff.
Yeah.
And quite often it's misattributed. It's attributed to pharmaceuticals, but people don't, they will report the pharmaceuticals that they're on, but they won't report the natural therapies that they're on.
I completely agree.
Yeah,
The week before last, I had a fierce reaction to something, and the antibiotic can make cured with the first dose, but it's just, I suppose, getting that balance and knowing what's worthwhile for what. And that's where, I suppose, self-information comes into play. Responsibility.
Yeah, it is a responsibility, and I think there is something to be said for allowing people to take a certain amount of responsibility for themselves and for their health, but where it becomes a grey area is where people are caring for other people. And, there's power influence there, like children who aren't allowed to gain, it goes into all sorts of, prayer therapy and things like that, where somebody's exerting a power over somebody else, and you have to be able to step in circumstances like that.
And say that that's bonkers.
Yeah, exactly, and just say no, you have to allow certain people to access medicine to allow them to recover from certain conditions. It is a grey area,
it doesn't seem to be a bridge at all.
No, because there's no, it doesn't want to be communication.
The complementary at all, so you can go into hospital and need to recover and be fed, shite pureed potato and not be sustained in your recovery, I don't know, I just think there's still a lot of work to be done to bridge those two worlds.
It's because there's a massive amount of distrust, mostly on the complementary health side.
Because of, like, as you described it, this whole sphere of multinational commercialism.
My wife had our son, the nurse told him to take Arnica C30 in the maternity hospital in Cork. So.
Yeah, it's something that's just, Arnica is one that seeped into the consciousness. And it's funny because Arnica, if you were to take it as a medicinal herb, will kill you. it's incredibly poisonous, but in homeopathic preparations, because none of it exists in it anymore, it's perfectly fine. And even to apply it to your skin, it can cause incredibly bad burns on somebody who has a bad reaction to it. But so you have to be quite careful about the ironic preparations that you get, and you know, it's one of those ones that you definitely never buy over the internet. But yeah, it is something that's there is a problem with allowing certain complementary therapies into the hospital environment, mm-hmm. because something that doesn't have an awful lot of evidence to back it up, if you're allowing it into that environment, you're giving it credence. You're allowing it a certain, you're giving it that cachet. And there's been huge problems in the US with healing touch. A lot of nurses have been trained in healing touch, and they genuinely think that they're doing good, but when they do double-blinded trials, there's absolutely no effect. But because now nurses themselves believe that they're doing something good, they don't want to let it go. So it's not something that's going to have an easy answer. I think it might improve because certain legislations around how medicines are patented and things like that will probably ameliorate over the next few years. Part of it is that if a multinational buys the rights to something, they're going to patent it in a way that allows nobody else to buy it, so they can make the most money out of it and they can sell it. And they're probably going to try and sell it in the guise in which it's most acceptable. And that might be as a pharmaceutical, or it might be as an alternative health. Mm. So they're also invested in this idea of keeping them
separate.
Yeah, and not allowing them to merge, because then you'd actually probably start to see the ones that really do work, and there'd be more competition and things would go down in price. Yeah. Mm. I don't know if there's an answer in there.
So, I think we don't have any more questions. Thank you very much. I think you mentioned that, you know, earlier on, some sort of special factor. So from a skeptical entertainment factor, I think you got a 10 out of 10 there.